Providence Bar. Down the Isla Vista, where police felt so harassed, they called the Special Riot Squad. The L.A. County Sheriff was there.
Thank you so much for joining me today. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. We have a special breaking news show today. We're going to be talking with environmental journalist, Mr. Steve Horn, who is a fellow with the Dismog blog. And also he'll be talking to us about some of his new stories that recently developed. And while we're waiting for him to tune in, we're going to go ahead and talk about some of the news stories that are bouncing around the airwaves. I want to talk just for a minute about the soldier who's just been released from the custody of the good people in Afghanistan. Now, it's true that this gentleman was a soldier, and the reports have it that he walked away from his post, although I overheard in one of the news shows that he wasn't actually active on a post at the time. He was going to go on duty, but he wasn't on duty at the time. And the thing that I find absolutely amazing is while our friends on the right wing of the political spectrum seem to be so enthusiastic about war, they don't seem to be very compassionate about the impact that war has on people who are engaged in it up close and personal. Now, we all know that there's been political prisoners in the past. We know that soldiers have been POWs in the past. And often they're under extreme pressure while they're in combat and while they're prisoners. Now, it seems that there's very little appreciation for the impact that war has had on this young man. And I find the rabid, uncalled-for accusations and imputations of the right wing to be just unconscionable. Now, this gentleman was in combat. He may not be an Audie Murphy, John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart hero, but he was a soldier. He was in combat. And let's see if we can find some compassion in our hearts before we try and convict this man before he's even back. Now, the other thing that I find rather amazing is the attacks on his parents. Now, I saw it reported on MSNBC this morning in what I have to call a completely over-the-top shouting match on the morning show, where essentially the parents were being vilified for telling the young man to follow his conscience. Now, it seems to me that the whole point of having individual freedom, the rights of man, and the fact that we stand for freedom for the individual and respect the rights of the individual, it is a necessity that we must respect the conscience of an individual human being. And it's also been reported that this young man, in letters back home, wrote that he thought that what he was doing over there and what his soldiers were doing over there was completely wrong and is in fact hurting the people of Afghanistan, and that the people who were in charge had no care whatsoever for anything beyond their own careers and the politics of the situation. And If your idea of helping a nation is by knocking down its doors and shooting its people, then you'd be just fine with all that. But let's at least reserve our judgment before we go attacking this individual, his family, or any other individual. Now, there were plenty of rumors about what former running mate of Sarah Palin did when he was a prisoner of war, but this is not to justify that. Prisoners of war do what they must to survive, and soldiers are impacted tremendously by policy. So let's make sure that we separate the respect for the individual from political policy and political agendas. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Stephen Horn. Steve, welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Listen, it's our pleasure, Steve. Once again, you're doing some just phenomenal reporting. Why don't you tell us what's going on right now? Do you want to talk about the fracking issue, or do you want to talk about the Petraeus situation? Go ahead, start.
Sure, well, we can talk about the Petraeus situation. Long story short there is I've been working on multiple rounds of open records requests in the state of North Dakota, where the former CIA director, David Petraeus, took a trip in late April. The trip at face value seemed just to be some sort of patriotic adventure to the state to learn about the oil and gas industry there, where the Bakken Shale is located, where lots of fracking for oil is conducted. But what I discovered was that out of that came some business deals between where he works now, which is Kohlberg, Kravis & Roberts, or KKR, a huge private equity firm in Midtown Manhattan, and the North Dakota State Investment Board. And so the first round of requests I got kind of hinted at there may be potential business deals to come in in the letter that I obtained that Petraeus wrote to someone at the North Dakota Lands Trust Department. And then subsequent requests have shown, and I haven't even written about this one yet, I'm working on that today, that request to the State Investment Board showed that in July, so about a month from now, month and a half, mid-July, these guys from the North Dakota State Investment Board are going to fly out to New York to set up some sort of investments with KKR. And the reason why it's not really unethical at face value, every state has the investment boards. They actually pool, maybe it is kind of a scandal because a lot of these firms are actually ripping off working class people, but state investment boards do invest a lot of money in Wall Street and in private equity. But the scandal really is that as part of that original trip, a woman who's on the board of the state investment board, state treasurer, Kelly Schmidt, had actually been cleared to fly in a private jet owned by KKR from one location to the other with Petraeus and a couple other guys from KKR under the auspices that there was no business to be conducted. But the reality is that there is business to be conducted. This trip in July is an exact result of that trip. And so that was kind of a key door-opening experience for KKR going on the ground in North Dakota, where they can learn about what's happening there. They can meet, do some networking, and in the future that means potential business deals. And listeners should realize and it's not that hard to figure out, the only reason that a private equity firm exists is to make money and make lots of money for their clients and for themselves, et cetera. So that's what's happening in North Dakota now. It was just kind of interesting to me. The reason why I even paid attention to it was because I've been following what Petraeus has been up to since he left the CIA after the affair that he had with Paula Broadwell, his biographer. And so I found the trip interesting because KKR also has investments in lots of stuff with oil and gas, including fracking, including in North Dakota. They own part of Sampson Resources, which is a major company doing fracking there, and they also own a mega housing complex there for oil and gas industry workers called The Ridge. And so immediately I knew that there was something more interesting about this trip than what was being presented, because all we really got from the media was a rehashing of a press release that was issued by the state treasurer's office, but I decided to look at the kind of story behind the story, and the story behind the story to me is potentially the state ethics laws were broken, and this is the beginning of another long-term relationship between the state of North Dakota, which is the epicenter of at least the fracking oil boom in the United States, and KKR, which is a major backer of unconventional oil and gas or fracked oil and gas in the United States, which has, by the way, $1 billion invested in oil and gas and a $4 billion energy portfolio out of their $87 billion total in assets. So it's a sizable portion of their total portfolio, to say the least.
I noticed you point out the fact that the press release was drafted by KKR. So they're kind of seeing the way for the state to step up to today's modern media standards, huh?
Yeah, I mean, so that was another part of the to walk it back a little bit, to talk about that first trip out there. The whole thing, including the press release, was choreographed by KKR, and the North Dakota state government was happy to play along and kind of make it seem like they were just being a partner, equal partner in the whole thing. But the reality was that KKR not only wrote the press release for that visit, it's now up on the North Dakota Treasurer's website. If you go to their website, there's an April 30th press release, and it seems like it was written by the state treasurer's office. But my records request showed that actually KKR drafted that whole thing. There was not even any editing done by the state treasurer's office. They just accepted it and then published it. And so not only that, but they made sure that the media didn't know all the details about what was happening and worked together to spin it the way that KKR wanted it, which to me, the way that I look at it is this probably wasn't as unique as we would like to believe. This is probably something that happens almost every day at the federal and state level for these type of events, these planned media events where, especially between corporate partners or Wall Street partners and state governments. So we think, to the public, it seems like it was, it just seems like it was sort of spontaneous or organic, but actually it's always much more well-planned and well-choreographed. And it raises troubling questions about any wall of separation that exists between governments and big corporations or huge private equity firms like KKR. And so that's sort of what that original investigation showed. And really at the end of it all did is raise the questions about these ethics laws issues. But that was the centerpiece of that first article, was actually more what you were talking about, the disappearing of the walls between government and state. And the state of North Dakota is, in particular, has become a petro state because it produces 1 million barrels of oil a day. It's already produced over 1 billion barrels since the Bakken Shale opened, really within the past decade or half decade. And so, and they're happy to open the floodgates for people like KKR to come in. And of course, we should all remember that the Bakken Shale is a field that, although it's doing well, there's a report out by the Post Carbon Institute that shows that within the next couple of years, already right now they're at a point where they're having to drill a lot more wells to keep up that rate of production, and they're sort of on a drilling treadmill. And in the coming years, it actually looks like that field is going to go in decline and then steep decline, so that means that it's really in a boom-bust life cycle. So a firm like KKR comes in to make quick money, but they have absolutely no commitment to the long-term viability of the state or the state's economy. And that's kind of a backdrop of the story, is they're there for the boom, and then they'll probably find a way through arranging of financing and such to profit from the bust as well, just as what happened with the housing boom not too long ago. We talked about the 2008 financial crisis. We're seeing something kind of similar, this huge boom for fracking in the United States, but a lot of these fields are now going in decline, as pointed out by the Post Carbon Institute in their study called Drill Baby Drill.
Another story that you bring us is about the the awarding of offshore leases and the coincidental press release that this is all part of the president's all-the-above energy strategy. Can you talk about that story?
Yeah, no problem. So I wrote an article that came out just about a day after President Obama announced, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy announced President Obama's details about the carbon rule that the EPA will be overseeing and the White House will be overseeing, and that has to do with regulating power plants that are fired by coal in the United States. And what happened is just a few days before then, kind of under the radar, and of course on a Friday.
The old Friday news dump.
Exactly. Friday news dump, they announced that they were following through with awarding some offshore oil and gas leases to ExxonMobil, which they won in a bid back in March under the auspices of the U.S.-Mexico Transboundary Hydrocarbon Agreement. So back in March, they won it through a bid, and that bill was actually passed by President Obama in Congress in December, and it's part of something broader that I've been covering and watching closely is energy reforms in Mexico, which are opening the floodgates for U.S. and international oil and gas companies to come in. They opened it up for international business, and it was formerly only controlled by Pemex, or I can't even pronounce it, and in Spanish I won't try, so it was called Pemex. So Pemex is a state-owned oil company, and they are now going to be partnering with international oil and gas companies. And so this is the first phase of it, is this transboundary hydrocarbon agreement, which is for offshore oil and gas that kind of is situated in between in the Gulf of Mexico on the U.S.-Mexico border. And so there was the basically three blocks were won by ExxonMobil in this bid. They were the only bidder.
I think that's really an interesting point that, yeah, there was an auction. Yeah, they won the bid. Oh, yeah, right. They were the only bidder. It must
only
have been
bidder.
A really competitive
yeah.
a bid there, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I'd have to look at the other. I didn't go ahead and look at the other bids. And this might be something that the bigger oil and gas companies do is to control pricing and control how much they pay for certain blocks. If you look at, because this was a certain, you know, a few that happened on this date in March. If you look at it, I think some of them were auctioned, purchased by Chevron. Some of them were purchased by ConocoPhillips. I think what they do is there's much less so than competition. There's much more sort of agreement between them. We get this, we get this, we get this. So $21 million for the amount of land they got is not very much for how much money they'll probably make off this oil and gas. And that's pretty significant. I wouldn't go ahead and say this is any type of bid rigging, but it is interesting just to look at how they operate in these types of forums. And so long story short there is that this is part of the – they held it, the Department of Interior – held it as sort of an achievement of the president's all-the-above energy plan. And looking at it through the lens of the carbon rule, it's important because the carbon rule is a pretty modest proposal, although you're going to hear a lot from right-wing Republican Party politicians that it's kind of a war on coal and a war on business, et cetera. The reality is that it's really a small proposal in the big scheme of things, and it's not going after any oil and gas companies. There's still quite a few loopholes for even the coal companies, and a lot of the coal companies and the business press are actually talking about how they're not all that. They're actually happy that the rule wasn't as tough as they thought it may have been. So that's all going on, and at the same time, all the above energy plan continues, and so I just thought it was telling that just literally the Friday before the Monday announcement, this big announcement was made kind of quietly by a major agency to do something so important. And really, I wanted to point it out because I think a lot of people aren't really aware of the fact that right now in Mexico, and their legislature, there's going to be really soon something called an extraordinary session to hash out the details of the constitutional amendments that were put in place in December that opened up their oil and gas reserves for international companies. So right now, it's constitutional amendments, but the legislature has to also sign some sort of bill. And so that's going on this month. And then potentially by 2015 or 2016, oil and gas companies may already come in and start doing development/production. And so it's happening really quickly in Mexico. And actually, this was just the first piece of it, is the stuff on the boundary. So I thought it was important to point that out too.
Well, I think another point that you made that was very interesting in that article was that Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell was formerly a petroleum engineer for Mobil. And
correct. Yeah.
She has just the right background to see us develop all those tediously spare natural lands that have yet to have a nuclear facility or an oil well or a fracking well on them.
That's correct. Yeah, I pointed that out because I don't think that, and it wasn't as explicit as to say that that's why ExxonMobil won that bid or anything, because if you look at all the other bids, other companies won bids too. But I think overall, it's just that she obviously has this background with the industry and
the old revolving door.
Exactly. And the same thing exists in the Department of Energy with Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz, and he although he didn't work for the industry directly, he was what I refer to as a fracademic. He worked at Massachusetts Institute for Technology, MIT, in Boston area, and he, while there, pulled in quite a bit of money through their Energy Institute from the oil and gas industry, and was co-author of several key studies that were funded by big oil and gas companies. And so those two agencies are both agencies that oversee oil and gas development, DOE at the global level and at the domestic level, and DOI, Department of Interior, that Jewell oversees at the domestic level and offshore. So those two, that kind of points to potentially a good explanation for why business as usual has continued, particularly this is the second term of Obama, that these two have only been in the Obama administration in term two. So that's why business as usual has continued, at least in the second term for President Obama. And I will say that, just to talk about the reverse revolving door for a second, since we're on the topic, the former Secretary of Energy under President Bush, Spencer Abram, and some other reporting I've been doing I haven't written about yet, but he is now a lobbyist, actually. He owns his own firm called Abram Consulting, I believe, and he is doing quite a bit of lobbying for gas exports, him and his firm, for LNG, liquefied natural gas. And they do the lobbying for Cheniere, which is the first company to ever get a final permit to do so by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commissioner, FERC. And so it really just goes to show the mechanics of both the revolving door and the reverse revolving door, so going from the industry to government or going from the government to industry. And it kind of also, it's sort of the same, that's the theme that continues with that first story we talked about in North Dakota, because look, Dave Petraeus was working for the United States government. He served basically his whole career up until now working for the military, then working for the CIA. Then immediately when he left, literally within a couple of months, even after a pretty, very, very much a scandal, not just a standard leave, even right after that, he goes immediately to work for private equity giant KKR. And so that's the theme that ties those two stories together for sure.
Not to put too much of a point on the whole scandal, but you have to wonder about the judgment of someone who's prepared to have an affair while they're head of the CIA, since, there's a great emphasis on making sure that you're above reproach and not liable for blackmail or not going to be substitute for any other outside pressures. And someone who's simultaneously head of the CIA and having a clandestine affair, it just doesn't seem to add up as a man with good, stable judgment.
Yeah, you know, actually, now that you mention the whole scandal thing again, one of the things that was the rationale behind the media spin that went into the whole visit to both Watford, North Dakota, and Bismarck, North Dakota, one of the key things was that Paul Broadwell is actually originally from Bismarck, North Dakota, and so the state treasurer on a radio appearance in response to my initial article, she went on a right-wing show hosted by this guy named Rob Port in North Dakota, and she said that there was a logical explanation for why they did that media stuff. The reason was that, well, look, Paul Broadwell was from Bismarck, and they didn't want that to kind of cloud the media coverage. And so really what she was saying is, as a government agency, we're happy to spin things in a favorable way to a guy who used to work for the United States government who now works for a big private equity firm, just for image reasons and for, just to keep his reputation going in a more positive direction after that happened. And so that's sort of the reading between the lines, what she was saying. And so that was telling to me as well. And, yeah, I mean, to answer your other question, of course, but I think that has to do with more with his hubris, you know, a person who, pretty young still, he's only just turned 60 years old, so from a young age really climbed the levers of power of the United States military, and this is documented pretty well in the book The Insurgents by Fred Kaplan, of how quickly he rose to power, and he's married to Holly Petraeus, whose father was a important military general, and so he rode those coattails and really climbed up the ranks quickly and got a nice cushy spot there where he studied counterinsurgency and ended up eventually writing the counterinsurgency field manual. And so, I think that more than anything, he thought that he literally could get away with anything. And eventually that came back to haunt him. But, yeah, the same thing happened, I would say the same exact thing happened to General Stanley McChrystal, who went on the record in that article in Rolling Stone to Michael Hastings and basically just was so arrogant, thought that a journalist would never publish what he was saying, and that journalist did, and, you know, within a day of that happening, a day or two of that happening, he was fired from his position as the high-ranking general in Afghanistan.
You brought up a point about Mexico opening up its oil fields to international oil. I looked at it, just looking at an article about it. One of the things that I find intriguing is that given the normal slow pace of the legislative process, here in a very short period of time, not only was there legislative changes made, it was a constitutional change made in the Mexican Constitution to get this made available. Now, if what they say is true, and I'll take their word for it, that there was some small degree of corruption in the Mexican petroleum industry, what does it say that they can suddenly and very, very quickly turn around and edit their constitution to allow other international powers that be in to exploit their product? Now, do you find that in any way interesting?
I find the whole thing interesting, yeah. I find, first of all, the pace at which this happened in last year. It really happened within a matter of months. If you think about a constitutional amendment ever passed in the United States, it would take, there's only been a couple dozen of them, so they take a long time, and it's in the decades, really, discussions about the issues until it happens. And so that's incredible. It was multiple constitutional amendments, first of all, and second of all, we don't really, I mean, I don't think anyone knows the full scope of how that happened so quickly. I don't think there's been no investigative journalism or no even like basic journalism about how that happened so quickly, at least in the English language. Potentially there's some in Spanish that I haven't seen yet, but all I had been reading was stuff in the business press, which only talked about what happened after the fact, not really the how the sausage was made in between. And so I suspect that there was a lot of important meetings between very powerful people, and at some point it just was something that they did. And I have read that there was some of the more left parties in Mexico, they have a multi-party system in their parliament. They weren't really too happy about this, and about the extent of it.
I was looking at the article.
I don't think that there was. Yeah, so, I mean, right now I still think is an interesting time because they're still debating the exact details of the rules, the law, of how it will be on the books after the Constitutional Amendment was signed. And I do wonder what the heck is happening on the ground there now. And I actually have been following pretty closely since the Constitutional Amendments were signed. And I just don't really see much in terms of English language stuff coming out in Google Alerts that I have set up about any of the how the sausage is being made. So
well,
it's kind of being done.
I was going to say there's a story in the Detroit Free Press that one of the state's legislatures approved it in 10 minutes.
Oh, man. Unbelievable. Yeah, and so it's, I mean, and we're talking about something that an article that was published back in January by a big bank called BBVA, which is headquartered in Madrid, Spain. One of their analysts came out and said that these reforms are as big and important as NAFTA, at least in terms of energy, as far as that goes. So this is not a small thing happening in Mexico. This is a complete revolution of how their energy industry is going to work mechanically. And it's really happening with almost no debate. I think most Americans don't even know that it's happening, even though it's happening right south of the border. And you know, lots of American companies are planning on being involved, and we already see they're scrambling for these transboundary hydrocarbons in the case of ExxonMobil and other companies in that most recent bid.
I'm afraid too many Americans find out their geography when they find out their children are being sent there for war.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one thing I want to say about Mexico that's really interesting and it does connect, actually, literally to the United States, is the Eagle Ford Shale Basin, which is the biggest oil field in the United States for fracking. Second biggest is the Bakken Shale, which we already talked about, North Dakota. The Eagle Ford Shale actually geographically runs, continues through the border. So Eagle Ford Shale is in Texas, but it's also in Mexico, and that will be a big part of this whole scramble is a lot of these companies who are doing it in the United States now in Eagle Ford Shale will now have an opportunity to do some fracking in Mexico. And then that will take years to set up, but that's a big part of the discussion from the industry perspective is now the Eagle Ford Shale being opened up in Mexico. And that's on top of all the offshore stuff that will now be opened up. And, a big part of this is, there's this talk of corruption with Pemex, as you mentioned. Corruption happens in two ways. There's organized, there's kind of the more ham-handed corruption that happens in lots of areas of the world, and there's more kind of institutionalized corruption that happens in the United States, just corruption by law, so it's legal for it to be corrupt. And so, like lobbying, organized corruption, basically that type of thing. And so what they're not mentioning, though, is that Pemex just doesn't have the technical know-how. They haven't built that up to do some of this unconventional drilling. So Pemex has primarily been a conventional oil and gas company. They do some offshore drilling, but not super deep water. And they do conventional kind of vertical drilling, the kind of drilling that we thought of before fracking came around. But what what the United States companies have developed an expertise in is this deep offshore drilling, and then also fracking. So really that's the real story, is the United States spreading this fracking technology and this deep offshore drilling technology around the world, not just in Mexico. For example, ExxonMobil is also helping Rosneft develop its shale, its shale oil in Siberia. And so Mexico is only a kind of one arena of many arenas around the world in which U.S. oil and gas companies are going to develop these unconventional reserves.
The same article says that Pemex is going to use its expertise on the areas that it's good at, and it's going to leave the rest of this to the international people. Now, that sounds like there's a big giveaway in play, and there'll be a...
I have also read that Pemex, part of the agreement is that Pemex wants about a 20% stake or in all these joint ventures, so just for in terms of the profits. So they'll still have a ownership stake, but the other companies have the, you know, they're the ones sharing the technology, and so that's why they'll have a bigger ownership stake, because without them, it couldn't happen.
Tell me, did you hear about the earthquake in Colorado, 2 miles from the fracking site?
No, I didn't. When did that happen?
Let's see, this was June 2nd, about 9:35 p.m.
Hydraulic fracturing has supporters and...
Hold on, just near Greeley, Colorado.
Oh, man, was that from fracking, or was that from fracking waste?
Well,
injection?
Depending, of course, on who you ask. Yeah, it was right near fracking.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the fracking waste is a... If it was that, which I'm guessing it maybe was tied to that, that's a huge issue. That's a huge issue, particularly in Ohio and Arkansas, those being basically dumping grounds for all the stuff that comes up from the wells after the fracking is done. And they need to do something with it, so they put it under the ground again through injection wells. And I've actually been doing a lot of research on the history of why they're allowed to do that and how they've been able to get away with it for so long. And it dates back to the 1980s. These wells, they've been exempt because they're not classified as Class 2 hazardous waste by the Environmental Protection Agency, dating back to the 80s under the Reagan administration. And nothing's changed since then in terms of the classification, so they're able to do it without any regulation, basically, because Class 2 hazardous wastes are regulated by the EPA, but because they're not classified as such, they've been able to do it at such a huge rate all over the country. Literally, you know, thousands of these wells around the country. There's been some good stories about it in ProPublica, and it's just a growing problem as more and more wells are being fracked around the country. That means more and more waste, and they need somewhere to put it, so it means more and more unregulated waste injection wells, and it is leading to earthquakes and other seismic activity. It's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, this was a 3.4, nothing to really sneeze at. And
right.
Yeah, this was from a online site called Echo Watch Transforming Green.
Okay,
so,
June
2nd. So let me ask you this. We've got these competing pressures. The president has announced his anything goes policy for energy, and yet we've got the government begrudgingly admitting that, yes, in fact, climate change is a reality, although saying it has been banned in several states. Do you take heart in the fact that, yes, it's been actually recognized by the federal government, or is your concern greater because these several states have now basically outlawed the discussion?
Yeah, you know, I'm more concerned by it than excited. A lot of people have given that caveat that, well, a lot of the policy is pretty bad and we're not really happy with it, but at least he's talking about it. I actually think that in a lot of circles, just him talking about it will be used sort of as a PR lover just to talk about how good he is on climate change and how responsible he's been. And I think that I don't want to give him that caveat or give anyone that caveat, doesn't matter who it is, because what's most important is just what's happening with climate change right now and what's happening with these extreme energy sources that are part of the all-above energy plan, like fracking, like offshore drilling, like the tar sands, like tar sands pipelines that are bringing the stuff to market. I think that if you don't recognize that and don't talk about it frankly, then I think that in its own way it's sort of a form of climate change denial just by not talking about policies that are causing climate change. And so, if you're just going to talk about climate change and then do all those other things, I don't personally see a huge difference between just denying that it exists or talking about it existing, but then not talking about the things that are causing it. So it's just sort of climate change and climate change denial in a different form, so to speak. And that's kind of how Oil Change International, who they do a lot of databases on following the money for campaign contributions in the oil and gas industry. That's how they've framed it, and I actually agree with that. It's kind of the framing that I had thought of in my own head, at least, but maybe not as bluntly as the way that they put it. And that's what I agree with. I think that we really need to sit down and talk about how we're going to tackle this huge challenge that is climate change, and we should hold all politicians accountable and corporations and others because the issue is so dire and we don't have a whole lot of time to waste with it.
You know, the other concern I have is that despite all the money that's been poured into the nuclear industry, the problems haven't been solved. They haven't even been ameliorated. They continue to grow. They continue to have expanding impact. The WIP site's problems, the site in Hanford's problems, and, of course, Fukushima, which I understand the premier of Japan has said won't impact the Olympics at all in a few years. I think that those mutated chickens will be coming home to roost for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's another thing that was actually, there was an article that came out, I think, in Green Wire or Energy Wire, one of those energy and environment news outlets, one of their sub-outlets, and they wrote about how the carbon rule actually basically is also green-lighting stuff with nukes in the United States in terms of subsidies. And that's the important, that's where the devil's in the details, so to speak, and that's the nuclear industry has always only been able to exist with huge state subsidies. Ralph Nader has been talking about that for a long time. The same thing goes for fracking. The industry got off the ground because of huge amounts of federal subsidies for research and development, and without it, it wouldn't have never happened. Actually, President Obama talked about that in one of his State of the Union addresses, and he was citing a study done by the Breakthrough Institute. And so the long story short is that that's going to continue under this carbon rule, because the carbon rule really only takes on coal at the power plant level, and then everything else still pretty much continues as business as usual, including those subsidies,
Steve,
the nuclear industry.
I want to thank you so much for joining us, and appreciate the breaking news items that you brought us. And you have a good day, sir, and stay safe.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, Steve. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Progressive News Network. Progressive News Network for today. And that was our news break. Stick around. Tune in Sunday when we're doing the Jazz Kings. Thanks again. Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network. Bye-bye.
using his Bank of America cash rewards credit card to cook.